Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said this morning that he wants to give the Saudis more time to finish investigating the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi before the United States decides how to respond.
I think it's important for us all to remember, too, we have a long, since 1932, a long strategic relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They continue to be an important counterterrorism partner. They have custody of the two holy sites. They are an important strategic alliance of the United States, and we need to be mindful of that as well.
The United States also has important economic ties to Saudi Arabia, and joining us now to talk about that is Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure. Robin, let's start with oil. How much oil does the U.S. import from Saudi Arabia?
Look, that's about $13 billion of imported Saudi oil, and that's about 4% of the dollar amount consumed. It's actually not that much when you consider all of the developments in the U.S. shale patch. This game has completely changed over 10 years.
And what about U.S. government bonds? We've been hearing in recent days that the Saudis own a lot. They're one of the biggest foreign buyers of U.S. treasuries.
Yeah, look, it was last clocked at $165 billion of U.S. government debt this summer, which sounds like a lot. But then you look at the likes of China and Japan, which have more than $1 trillion each. These are the two biggest foreign holders of U.S. government securities. They could, if they wanted, kind of hold us hostage on that. But it cuts both ways. The Saudis, they really can't do it. Oil shipments are dollar denominated for the most part. They need a stable dollar. They are very threatened by too strong a dollar. So it's a situation where you really have to put it in perspective.
Another important part of the relationship that has come up is arms. The president of the United States has mentioned that the Saudis buy billions of dollars of arms from the U.S. He says $110 billion. That number is disputed. But then we heard this from a fan of President Trump's, evangelist Pat Robertson, who spoke earlier this week on the 700 Club.
We've got an arms deal that everybody wanted a piece of. It's like, what is it, $190 billion? It's huge. And it'll mean a lot of jobs, and it'll be a lot of money coming to our coffers. And it's not something that you want to blow up willy-nilly.
So Pat Robertson there telling President Trump maybe not to go too tough on the Saudis if it is found that they have something to do with Khashoggi's death.
Saudi Arabia still counts for less than 1% of United States international trade through this summer. And when you look at arms, you see that $100 billion figure bandied about. It's actually $3.2 billion of defense exports. I think the president and the secretary of state, they kind of want to secure this great relationship in that Trump went to Riyadh, he hosted the Saudi prince here, and he had these enormous sales and that stuff that he could sell to defense contractors in a midterm election year. In reality, the numbers are far smaller on an annualized basis.
One other thing I want to ask you about is the tech industry. We were hearing that Uber has a big investment from Saudi Arabia. We remember that when Elon Musk famously said he was going to take Tesla public at $420 a share, part of that was about having a big investment from Saudi Arabia. There are a lot of big tech names that get a lot of money from Saudi.
That's right. I mean, they're an enormous venture investor and the sovereign wealth fund. You have to understand oil is so hugely profitable for them, and they've been looking to diversify for decades, especially under this prince. But the thing to remember is that these are fungible investors. For example, you know, there are people that would line up to take that stake off of his hands in Uber or Tesla. There are Korean investors. There are Japanese investors. There are people here in the United States. So while it sounds big, and the president and the state secretary and even Pat Robertson are trying to make it sound big, it's certainly replaceable by other players in the global economy. Saudi Arabia is big, but not all that big.
What would it mean for Saudi Arabia? And as you say, they've been trying to diversify their economy. If they weren't able to have these investments in the United States?
I think it's a project for him. I mean, look where he came to the United States and he met with these tech investors. He met with Mike Bloomberg. It's an image that they very much wanted to project, that we're coming out of the desert and we're very much espousing this century where, you know, look at Singapore, look at Norway, how they've turned their flush domestic coffers into investments and things that are more tangible. That's something that he was really trying to sell And Trump was really trying to sell these guys as an indispensable trading partner and ally in the Middle East. And that's hugely jeopardized by all you're seeing in the news right now.
That's Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the midterm elections are less than 3 weeks away. So a closer look now at the Senate race in Tennessee, where the most recent polling shows Marsha Blackburn, the Republican candidate, increasing her lead over the Democrat Phil Bredesen, a development some are attributing to fallout over Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's fraught confirmation. Sergio Martinez Beltran is the political reporter at Nashville Public Radio. Hi, Sergio.
Hi, Robin.
So these names are familiar. Neither candidate a stranger to politics. Bredesen was mayor of Nashville, governor of Tennessee. Blackburn, a congressman since 2003. And apart from the fact that she does prefer the word congressman, remind us about Marsha Blackburn.
Well, Marsha Blackburn has been a staunch supporter of President Trump. She's made sure that the Make America Great Again agenda is implemented in Congress. And so she is very famous in Nashville and in Tennessee.
Yeah. And we know she's far to the right. In 2004, she invited the known Confederate secessionist, the Reverend David O. Jones, to deliver the opening prayer for the House of Representatives. And this is the man who at the time was heading up the League of the South. They played a big role in organizing the Charlotte protests. Does she still maintain links to those kinds of, you know, what some people would call hate groups?
She said she doesn't. And of course, that's the same rhetoric that we hear from other politicians as well, that sometimes they are invited to these events where people like the ones you mentioned are the ones who organize them. And then they try to backtrack and say, well, they just invited me. That doesn't necessarily mean that they support them.
Well, there's that. But let's listen to one of her ads. It's a montage of supporters.
I voted Phil Bredesen for governor.
I supported him.
But I cannot support Bredesen for Senate.
Bredesen opposed this bill in the wall.
He supports Obamacare.
Bredesen opposed Trump's tax cuts.
That's a non-starter for me.
Bredesen gave crooked Hillary tons of money.
Ugh.
And now Washington Democrats are behind him.
I can't support Bredesen for senator.
Mm-mm.
Nope. Nope.
I just can't do it.
Not this time.
I'm Marsha.
So an ad there from Marsha Blackburn's campaign, looking like it really wants to lash Phil Bredesen to the Democratic Party. And we also heard Blackburn supporters referencing the fact that voters did at one point vote for Bredesen who may not now. So talk about what his track record is and whether or not any of this even matters, his track record, given the combustible politics of today.
It does matter. Governor Bredesen, he is very charismatic. Everyone knows him in the state. And he has always wanted to play this moderate guy, right? He wants to make sure he reaches across the aisle. When he was a governor, he worked with Republicans. He worked with Democrats. And he always talks about that. Governor Bredesen has also been trying to avoid Democratic endorsements, which is very interesting. So, for example, he said that if he were to be elected to the U.S. Senate, he would not be supporting Democratic leadership. So he would not be supporting Chuck Schumer. And he's been talking about that. He's been talking about how the Democratic Party needs new leadership. So he's trying to, again, appeal to the moderates, appeal to those Republicans who might be on the fence, but also being appealing to the Democrats.
Yeah, the Democrats on the left who have been making a showing at the polls in recent elections. So let's listen to one of Governor Bredesen's ads. These are his supporters.
I'm a lifelong Republican.
I'm a Republican.
I'm a Republican, but I'm supporting Phil Bredesen because he can work across the aisle and work with both parties.
He worked with Democrats and he worked with Republicans.
Sometimes that means he doesn't make everybody in his party happy.
Phil was fiscally responsible.
He worked with Republicans to bring Volkswagen to town.
200,000 new jobs while he was governor.
He gets things done.
Phil's certainly different than the crowd in Washington.
So there you have an ad from Governor Bredesen's campaign. He's the Democrat, but obviously, just as you said, Sergio, he's trying to get those moderate Republicans who may be feeling that Marsha Blackburn's too far to the right.
That's right. And he doesn't make everyone happy. Like the ad says, for example, he recently came out saying he would have voted for Justice Kavanaugh, something that goes against the majority of the Democrats who were rallying against the justice. So he is trying again to show that he is a moderate, that he's willing to listen to both sides and then make a decision on behalf of Tennesseans. That's what he's been saying during the whole campaign. But that's something that the Blackburn campaign and specifically Marsha Blackburn has, used as part of that, attack. At one of the debates, Blackburn said that he had the chance to run as a Democrat. He had the chance to run as a Republican or as an independent, but he chose to run as a Democrat. So he's part of the establishment. That's what Marsha Blackburn has tried to say during this whole campaign.
In trying to get the moderate Republicans away from Marsha Blackburn, and doing things like being in favor of confirming Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, does he run the danger of putting off people who have been loyal Democrats for years?
It definitely affects him. And he's running with this thing that he hasn't in the past, and it's that some of his volunteers are even leaving his campaign. Hmm. They can't stand why he supported Brett Kavanaugh. And so that's something that it's going against him, and he needs to figure it out before the election.
Yeah, sounds like it. Sergio Martinez Beltran, the political reporter at Nashville Public Radio, as we take a look at the Senate race there in Tennessee and our weekly Senate tracker. Sergio, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
A week after Hurricane Michael hit, parts of North Florida are still reeling, as you no doubt know. The death toll has been rising, power could be out for weeks, and we're learning how far inland the storm wreaked some of its havoc. Rodney Andreasen is Emergency Management Director in Jackson County, Florida. He's in Mariana, where there were three deaths. And Rodney, you're an hour north inland from the Gulf Coast. What happened where you are?
Right. We took a direct hit. So when it hit us, it was right at a high Cat 3, low Cat 4, which is somewhat unusual for inland hurricanes, but this is becoming a norm on a lot of places, and people don't realize that the storm does affect people that deep inland. And when you've got a storm of this magnitude and moving as fast as it did, it held together a lot better.
Yeah.
And that's why we got such an impact.
Well, and the impact included you. Do I understand your home was hit?
Yes, it was. It was heavily damaged, and pretty much it is destroyed. The structure stood. The house basically overpressurized. It blew part of my roof off, and we're hoping to get some adjusters on it today.
Yeah, well, we're sorry to hear about that, but we know you're in good company there. Just give us a thumbnail of what Mariana looks and feels like.
It does look like, I spent 21 years in the military, and it's the damage is just off the scales bad. Mm. And buildings down. Almost every tree has been affected, snapped off halfway up. Mm. And it's a landscape I've never seen. People coming back that used to live here and come back so they don't even recognize the town.
Well, the county appraiser, Carla Peacock, told the Tampa Bay Tribune that she's guessing that 90% of the homes and businesses in the whole county, Jackson County, were damaged. She's using tax rolls and aerial pictures. Is that your sense?
I sense that. We had a crew go out and take a look, and they gave us an estimation that approximately 582 structures that they were able to look at were severely damaged. Mm. 400 plus are completely destroyed. So you're looking at 1,000 structures have been just damaged or destroyed.
Well, someone with Gulf Power, a spokesperson, said this isn't a restore that's ahead. It's a rebuild of the entire electrical grid. And we understand it's a patchwork of city and cooperative utilities, and that after big storms in 2005 and 2006, the utilities were told, do more tree trimming, improve the power lines, maybe put some of them underground to prepare for these storms. Do you think there was a failure to do that, or do you think anything could have been done?
Right. I can say personally and professionally that the power companies did everything they could do. I can tell you unequivocally, they do an unbelievably awesome and difficult job. And they have had very aggressive programs to trim back those trees, to upgrade that grid. And I see people putting power lines underground, and yes, that is a good idea, but it also causes its own unique issues when you do that. But no, the power companies have been, I mean, I can tell you, have done an absolutely awesome job at upgrading things.
What are some of the issues? Because I think we heard in one report that Verizon is out in one area, but it's because their underground cables were affected.
And that happens because people don't realize that fiber does run between towers. And our biggest problem with that was the tower stood, the cables stood. It's just there was so much debris down, they could not get back to ensure the propane tanks refill for the generators, so the generators stopped, so they were not transmitting.
Look, you've got the personal here, but also the professional. What do you think should happen? A measure to improve communications among the utility companies and another to fund a study on storm response failed in the state legislature in 2017. Do you think the state needs to get back to, you know, some form of high-level, you know, emergency convening on what to do going forward?
We're looking at an infrastructure in this country that is 50, some of it's 100 years old. We need to take a very hard and fast look at all our critical infrastructure and see what we've got to do to fix it.
I've got to ask you, Rodney, just briefly, does there also have to be more of an acknowledgement that something is happening because of climate change?
I don't know if it's so much climate change as it is. It's just a natural process that occurs over the years.
You don't think this is, I mean, you're looking at an hour inland from the coast,
right,
a town wiped out, and, you know, every scientist worth their metal saying that this is a direct result of warming waters.
And I'm sure there might be some issues of that, but I'll be honest with me, at my level, it's not a question of climate change. It's a question of changing the climate of people getting ready for these things. Yeah. And I can almost guarantee you this will change the climate of my community and the attitude of those in this area.
Well, Rodney Andreessen there in Jackson County in Mariana, Florida, we wish you the best.
Okay, thank you very much.
Parts of the country are lucky enough to be in pear season, so we want to take a closer look with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who's in the studio. Hi.
Hi, Robin.
You know, I have to say I'm one of those people, I love pears. I think they are an art form. I have pear cookbooks, pictures of pears, and all I do is use them in salads with blue cheese.
Okay, well, your whole pear world is about to get blown out of the park, if okay. I do say so.
Okay, talk about varieties.
Okay, well, the most common one that we see in grocery stores is the Anju or mm-hmm. Anju. There is a red Anju, and then there's also a bright green one, which is kind of an egg shape. They tend to be soft, juicy. Mm-hmm. They're great raw, but they hold up to poaching and baking as well. You're going to find, as I describe these, that it's an incredibly versatile fruit. Mm-hmm. Most of all of them can be cooked as well as eaten raw, and they are somewhat, if not completely, interchangeable.
How about the dark brown ones that seem to have a tougher skin?
Okay, so that's called an Asian pear, and I cut one up for you right mm-hmm. there. They are very crunchy, very tart, sweet also. These are best eaten raw. To me, an Asian pear tastes like a pear mating with a water chestnut. Mm. It's got that wonderful crunch and a little bit of juiciness, and wonderful in salads, wonderful grated also. Bartlett's, another very common variety, very sweet, red and green as well. They are crisp. They are wonderful texture for poaching. What I love about them is that they retain their shape when you cook them. There's also Bosque pears, same deal. Very earthy flavor. And Bosque pears have an elongated neck, which is really fun because when you poach them, it has this elegant long top.
Well, talk about the poached, because we have one
right here.
Right? This
do.
Seems so hard.
I'm really glad you said that because I am going to absolutely show you how wrong you are.
Okay.
All right, here's what I did. You
mm-hmm,
ready?
Mm-hmm.
I peeled a pear, but I kept the stem on.
Yeah.
Okay, I peeled it.
Okay.
You with me?
It's naked.
It's naked.
Mm-hmm.
I took a cup of sugar
mm-hmm.
and a cup of white wine and 2 cups of water, and I boiled them.
Mm-hmm.
I could add a cinnamon stick. I could add some fresh ginger to that. I let it cook down. That's called a simple syrup.
Mm-hmm.
I place my naked, as you call them, pears into the syrup, and I let them cook for about 25 to 30 minutes. And what happens is the pear releases its juice into the syrup, and the pear then cooks in this sweet, delicious gingery syrup. It can be made well ahead of time. It keeps in the syrup. You can eat that for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
You could eat that as part of a salad. but you certainly could serve that for dessert. You don't need whipped cream. It's healthy, it's light, and I think it's so refreshing.
Oh my.
Right?
Yeah.
But the other thing about pears is that they swing both ways. They're savory and they're also clearly sweet. Mm-hmm. So I made a savory salad that's a little bit different than a normal pear salad. I took, in this case, I believe I used a Bartlett pear. Mm-hmm. I peeled it. I put a tiny bit of olive oil, salt, and pepper on it, and I roasted it in little wedges. Mm. And then I have fresh spinach and fall greens. And I put my roasted pear around it. Then I took some French bread or baguette, toasted it in thin slices, and spread blue cheese on top. And then I caramelized pecans in a little bit of maple syrup. So you have crunchy, green, tart, pungent from the blue cheese, and sweet and voluptuous from the pears.
Wonderful.
Oh, and there's also sun-dried cranberries, a seasonal specialty, in the vinaigrette.
Okay, we have this. What is this?
This is an upside-down pear cake. Mm. Now, you've probably heard of upside-down pineapple cake, and it's very similar. I used a variety. I used Comus. I used a Forelli pear, which are smallish. That means trout in German, and it's got a wonderful, firm, tart flavor. And then I also used a Bosque pear. So I melted some butter and brown sugar and let that cook. And then I laid the pears down in that. And I made a very simple cake batter using all these spices that just remind you of fall. Cinnamon, allspice, ginger, and cardamom. And you make this cake batter, you put it on top of the pears, and you bake it. You take it out of the oven, and your house smells like pear and apple picking on an gorgeous autumn day. You know, it's heaven. Mm-hmm. And after about 10 minutes when it's cooled, you flip the skillet upside down and you have this beautiful upside down pear cake.
Just beautiful. By the way, keeping pears, refrigerated? No?
Yes. Rarely do you find a perfectly ripe pear in the store. They're harvested when they're mature but not yet ripe, because once a pear ripens, it only keeps for a few days.
Right.
So you want to ripen it out of the fridge, and as soon as it starts to get soft and fragrant, put it in the fridge if you're not going to eat it right away. And the way that you tell if it's ripe is that the skin often brightens in color. It will become greener, or you'll see this blush of red. And you push on the neck, which is the elongated part on top of the fruit. And if it yields, it's ripe. Now, we're not talking mush like your thumb falls into it. That's overripe. So again, don't refrigerate unripe pears, but do refrigerate them after they've ripened at room temperature.
Okay. Here in our resident, Chef Kathy Gunst. Wonderful as always. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
At a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday, there were no Democrats present, but Senator John Kennedy, a Republican, opened the hearing anyway.
Senator Grassley asked me to read a little statement here. I'd like to briefly mention why we're holding this hearing while the Senate's in recess. It's because Ranking Member Feinstein agreed to hold this hearing.
And with that, the Republicans who were present began to review nominees to federal court judgeships. The office of the senior committee Democrat, Dianne Feinstein, denied that she agreed to the hearing as characterized. In fact, Democrats were so infuriated by the Republican effort to push through more confirmations that they boycotted yesterday's meeting. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson is here to talk about this. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Jeremy.
So after the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, Senate Democrats agreed to confirm 15 lower court judges before recessing until the midterms. But now they say Republicans broke a promise regarding judicial nominees. What's going on here?
What's going on here is that the Republican Party and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have made basically an a bet that one of the significant and lasting accomplishments during their tenure is going to be the confirmation of federal judges, mostly young, conservative, white, male federal judges, to lifetime appointments on district courts and federal appeals courts around the country. And these Republicans are not going to let things like the Senate recess stop them. So yesterday they went ahead and held a hearing for six judicial nominees, even though Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat from California, the top Democrat on the committee, as you noted, Jeremy, was actually at home in California preparing to debate her opponent because right. she's running for re-election. Other Democrats didn't show up either. In fact, very few Republicans actually showed up for this hearing. So the nominees got a very, very light round of questioning and moved along.
Is there anything Democrats can do to stop Republicans from doing this?
Yeah, they can win elections. Republicans control the White House, and Donald Trump has been nominating these young conservatives for the federal bench, and Republicans control the Senate, which has the advice and consent function here. So if Democrats really want to do something, they're going to need to win more elections. Now, if you talk to progressive advocates and activists out there, they say that Democrats could have been firmer in standing up last week and not agreeing to this deal to confirm 15 federal mm-hmm. judges before they left town for the recess. There are some things on the margins that Democrats could do more of, but by and large, the Republicans hold the power here, and they are using it.
And just give us a sense of what we missed yesterday. Who got through?
Yes. So the main focus of yesterday's hearing was a young woman lawyer named Allison Rushing. She's been nominated to serve on the Federal Appeals Court for the Fourth Circuit. Jeremy, she is only 36 years old. She's one of the youngest people we have seen in a generation or two nominated to a federal appeals court. She was a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and also a clerk for Neil Gorsuch, now on the Supreme Court. She has conservative bona fides and is highly regarded in that conservative elite legal community out there.
Not that there's anything wrong with 36-year-olds, because I'm 36 right now. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now, and some classical music fans have been marking the 275th anniversary this year of the birth of the Italian cellist and composer Luigi Boccherini. Maybe not a household name, but some think it should be, and that's where we turn for this week's DJ session, a Boccherini edition. Vic DiGeronimo is host of Classic Mornings on WILL in Urbana, Illinois. Vic, welcome back.
Jeremy, it's great to be back. Thank you.
And you wanted us to start with the minuet from the string quintet in E major. This is played by the Smithsonian Chamber Players. Very familiar tune there. This was actually made famous by the 1955 movie The Lady Killers, about a group of thieves that rents an apartment from a widow in London, and that they say they're a string quartet that just want to use the room to practice. This is a song that they play. I've heard this in a lot of movies since then. Tell us about it.
If anybody has ever said they haven't heard anything of Luigi Boccherini, right. they have indeed. They've heard right. this piece. And in our time, it became famous in the 1950s in that film. But I understand that in the late 19th century, that there were arrangements that were made. This piece went viral in its time, you could say. There were arrangements for mandolins, for piano, for saxophone, for a cappella choir with a Latin text added. So this piece has been popular well before 1955. The fun thing about the Lady Killers and the use in the film, this is a work that's written for a string quartet, two violins, viola, cello, with an additional cello. Now, there's a joke about the film. It's either an error in the film or it's an additional joke in that these crooks pose as a string quintet with an additional viola. And not with a cello. So somebody should have been on to this early on that these guys are walking around without a second cellist.
You know, the other film that it's in, one of my favorites, is Ferris Bueller's Day Off. This is what they play when they go into the fancy restaurant in Chicago and try to get in where they're not supposed to be. But it's been in a lot. I want to listen actually to another version of the same piece. This is the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra with Bobby McFerrin conducting and on vocals. You know, when I said Bobby McFerrin on vocals, I was waiting to find out what that meant exactly. But there you have it. He's not singing necessarily, but he is humming along to the tune.
Bobby McFerrin is being Bobby McFerrin.
Right, exactly.
And I think it's a fascinating arrangement of it for our time. If you like this piece, you should know that Luigi Boccherini wrote over 100 string quintets. This is one simple minuet from one quintet, so there's a lot more there to explore. He was writing these for the younger brother of the Spanish king, Dom Luis, and while he was doing it, he was writing string quartets for royalty and playing the additional cello himself. So he was doing this so that he could play along with them. And then he would also write string quintets for the Prussian king, who was a cellist. So he had a lot of opportunities to write string quintets and string quartets in addition to other chamber music.
What do we know about what influenced Boccherini? Who influenced him?
Well, he was a cellist. Early on, he learned the cello. He also learned singing. His father was a double bass player. He and his father were playing in orchestras, and he realized that he couldn't make a living just by being a cello virtuoso, that he had to compose music. So he began to compose music, and he ends up getting very wealthy patrons who demand a certain kind of music, and that seemed to influence his writing chamber music rather than, say, operas at the time.
Well, let's get to another from Boccherini, and this is the Cello Concerto in G Major performed by the Canadian Tafel Musique Orchestra and Honor Bilsma on the cello. This is conducted by Jean Limon. There with the cello.
Jeremy, you're a cellist, right?
Exactly. I was, until age 14
were.
Or something.
you have to admire this. It's melodic playing, and in the concertos, there's a lot of virtuosic writing as well. And I think those two things sort of define Boccherini in many ways. So he was a virtuoso and wrote parts for a cellist in his concertos. And he's also known for having been gifted in writing melodies. And I kind of wonder if he would have ever written more than the couple of operas that he wrote late in his life, whether he would have been a great opera composer. But here we get both sides of him in the cello concertos.
Okay, now to one of his symphonies. This is the Symphony No. 3 in G major, played by the London Mozart Players. So one of the things that I hear there is that this was obviously recorded in a big hall, which I love that you can tell that by listening there. But what do you hear that tells you something is a Boccherini piece?
You can hear, again, this gift for melody. And he's writing this in a symphony. Haydn was writing symphonies at the time. It's been suggested that Boccherini was so detail-oriented that maybe he didn't have an ear for the architecture of a full symphony. It's funny. There's a contemporary of Boccherini, violinist composer Jean-Baptiste Cartier, and he has a famous line that if the Almighty wished to speak through music, it would be that of Haydn. If the Almighty wished to listen to music, it would be that of Boccherini. Hmm. And Boccherini had that gift for melody and had the gift for the detail. And you can hear that just in this portion of the Symphony No. 3 by Boccherini.
Why do you think, then, that he is not as well-known as Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin, Tchaikovsky, and others?
It could be that most of his music is chamber music. And I would say that the appeal of chamber music is not as great as, say, the appeal for orchestral music. And that's not that he didn't write orchestral music. And I think it's becoming a little bit better known. But I think compared to those other composers, there isn't as much of it. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's not as popular in our time.
That's Vic DiGeronimo, who is host of Classic Mornings on WILL in Urbana, Illinois. Very interesting to learn about Boccherini there and hear some of his music. Vic, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. That's NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Today, Prime Minister Theresa May said the UK's transition out of the European Union could be extended to deal with the Irish border issue.
We are working with the European Union to deal with this issue of ensuring that if there is a gap between the end of the implementation period and the point at which the future relationship comes in, we want to ensure there's no hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
That's Theresa May at the Brexit Summit in Brussels today. Also there, NPR Berlin correspondent Soraya Sahardi-Nelson. Soraya, first of all, start, for those who haven't been following this as it heats up, with this issue with the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, no hard border, as Theresa May is saying, but with Brexit, you know, when that goes through, there would have to be one.
Well, that's what both sides, the EU included, want to avoid. There are several reasons for that. One is that there's a peace deal, or the main one perhaps, is that there's a peace deal that's rather fragile still in Northern Ireland. So by having a border, you end up creating friction that could have that deal blow apart. So both sides actually don't want a hard border between the Republic of Ireland, which remains with the EU, and Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK.
And right now, it's this fluid place. I mean, you literally step from someone's backyard into someone else's backyard, and there's a lot of commerce between the two.
Absolutely. The EU has the fact that this has been an open border is something that's it's promoted commerce, it's promoted good relations, and again, it's kept the peace. The issue is, though, if the UK steps out of the European Union, as is the plan under Brexit, there has to be a border somewhere. And that's where they just can't agree on. I mean, the Europeans have talked, or the EU, I should say, has talked about doing it in the Irish Sea. The UK has talked about maybe having some of their agencies and authorities handling the customs and the border controls, and that's something that EU doesn't want. So there's just a lot of disagreement over exactly how to create a hard border. Yeah. But they do agree it shouldn't be between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
And what about her sense that there's going to be an extension? Is everyone on board with that?
Well, this is interesting because a little later today, after Theresa May's statement, Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, stood up and said, let me just make it clear that the 27 other members did not once talk about transition during a transition period or extending the transition period during the meeting on Brexit. And the implication from Theresa May was more that this was a proposal that had been floated, and not just Theresa May, others had sort of mentioned that this was a European proposal. So there was some confusion about who was promoting this. But what's clear is that Mr. Tusk has said that they would be amenable to extending it, but this is not something under consideration right now. They actually need to come up with a deal, whereas Theresa May, and she doesn't even like to call it a transition period, she calls it an implementation period, says that it's an idea that's been floated that is something that could be considered if it, I should say, eases the debate over the hard border issue between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
I heard you say something earlier today on Morning Edition. I just caught a bit of it, so I don't want to paraphrase. I'd like you to say it. There was this sense that some of the other attendees at this meeting were off, you know, having a snack, sort of sending a signal that they weren't taking things so seriously. What was going on?
Well, this summit had been portrayed last month by Donald Tusk in Salzburg. They were having an informal summit. That this summit this week here in Brussels was the make or break of a deal for Brexit. And then this week, it's like, okay, we don't have an agreement. It's not as critical as we thought. We still have time. All the things that they were saying last month were not the case. And so punctuating that was the fact that this dinner meeting at which the 27 member states that will be remaining in the EU, their leaders had a dinner meeting. And then right afterwards, four of the members, and this would be Germany, Luxembourg, Belgium, and France, their leaders went out for French fries and beer here in Brussels to really accentuate the fact that no one seems to be that alarmed about the fact that there isn't a deal.
Yeah. Look, you're based in Berlin. Chancellor Angela Merkel just suffered another election setback last weekend. What is her position on Brexit? And how is this affecting her political strength? It's kind of the ripple effect of it.
She's toned down her harshness. I mean, she still is adamant that there has to be a deal because the latest estimates show that Germany could lose upwards of $110 billion if Brexit goes through without some sort of deal. So there's a lot riding on this for Germany. But she's also toned down. I mean, she doesn't want to make this, I guess, look like yet another thing that she hasn't been able to handle. So she talked instead at this summit, and she did not make many public statements. But the one she made was that I have a skill at, or I always look at creating consensus and finding an agreement, and that's what I'm going to focus on because I still think that we can do this. One thing I should mention, there really is a sense among the remaining 27 members, or the other, I should say, 27 members of the bloc, that the UK is basically on purpose delaying this in order to force concessions, like to put the pressure to a point where there's no time left and the EU will have to cave. Mm-hmm. Of course, the UK sees it the opposite way as well.
Yeah. That's NPR's Berlin correspondent Soraya Sahardi-Nelson in Brussels at the Brexit summit today. Soraya, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.